Well, another week of big numbers for Caitlin Clark. Believe it or not, we're still talking about the Caitlin Clark effect, even after the NCAA Women's Basketball Tournament has concluded, because she was drafted into the WNBA on Monday, and the draft had 2.5 or 2.45 million viewers on ESPN, easily the biggest WNBA audience in 24 years since Memorial Day, the year 2000. Houston, New York, in a WNBA Finals rematch on NBC that led into Reggie Miller and the Pacers against Patrick Ewing. Well, actually, Ewing was hurt, and the Knicks. That's how far back we're going. The Caitlin Clark effect for maybe the sixth straight week, the lead story on the Sports Media Watch podcast. I'm John Lewis, joined as always by Drew Lerner. Don't forget to subscribe at the SMW podcast feed on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and more. So let's just dive on in as usual. Like I said, 2.45 million viewers for the WNBA draft, more than four times the audience last year, 572,000. Just another unbelievable increase for someone who has become really the biggest single driver of television ratings we've seen in sports, maybe that I can remember. Because, you know, you talk about Tiger Woods, the difference between Tiger being in the field and Tiger not being in the field is not the same thing as the difference between pre-Caitlin Clark and Caitlin Clark. Tiger took a sport in golf that was doing all right and took it to places that it had not reached. Caitlin Clark is taking a sport in women's basketball, college and now pro, that has never been a particularly big draw. Even in the days of Cheryl Miller, when the final might get 11 million viewers, it was never a particularly big draw. And she has taken that sport to a level that I don't think anybody thought was possible. And remember, she's not played a single professional game. So who knows where this goes from here. Drew, I'll bring you in on that note.
Yeah, honestly, John, I think this is the most surprising number of them all that I've seen from a Caitlin Clark fueled audience. And the reason is the result was all but known already, right? Like, we knew going in that she was going to be the number one draft pick by the Indiana Fever. So 2.5 million people still turned on their TVs to watch something they already knew was going to happen. To me, that's the incredible part. And, you know, this is what a like 2-hour window that ESPN had for this draft. So maintaining an average audience of 2.5 million for something that everyone already knew was going to happen and also happened at pretty, you know, shortly after the telecast began, that makes this number all the more impressive, not to mention all the superlatives you kind of laid out about how this is the largest WNBA audience of any kind since the turn of the millennia, that WNBA hadn't had a audience over 1 million viewers since 2008. I mean, this is pretty incredible, and I think any questions about Caitlin Clark's ability to draw as a professional have been answered already.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And the point you made about the draft is really important as well. For years, the WNBA draft, ESPN would air the first round and the rest of it would be on ESPNU. So the numbers you might see from 2004, the previous record, that's just for the first round. It's only since COVID that ESPN started carrying the whole thing. ESPN carried the whole thing in 2020 because there was nothing else going on and just continued to do that since. So it's only been a few years that it's been the entire draft. So that means 2.45 million viewers per minute, not just when Caitlin Clark was drafted, but also when the third round pick, who's never going to play a minute, was drafted, right? And that's unbelievable for this event. We have not seen yet the peak numbers. ESPN has not put out a release yet as of our taping early Tuesday evening, but I'm sure they will soon. And that will be an interesting number to see. What was the audience when Clark was drafted? Then what was the audience when Reese was drafted? You know, Reese was drafted 7. So I was wondering what that number will be. How many people stuck around for Reese? And then what would be really interesting is what was the number at the end? You know, I mean, the hockey game that followed was under 500,000. I suspect that by the final quarter hour of the WNBA draft, probably around, you know, 600,000, 700,000, who knows. But that's still a massive audience. It's just unbelievable exposure for the WNBA. The broadcaster did a lot of world building. WNBA, as I said last week, doesn't really tell people what's going on in the WNBA. So this broadcast did that. The broadcast told people about things that I didn't even know about. Apparently, they're saying that Seattle is going to be a super team this year because they signed Ogumike and Sky Diggins Smith, which I don't think that doesn't sound like a super team to me, but whatever. They're saying that's a super team. I didn't even know about that because even though I do watch the WNBA, I'm not following the offseason very closely. So for people who don't even watch the league, they're learning about these teams and these storylines that they don't even know anything about. It's the biggest promotional opportunity in the history of the WNBA.
John, I saw you earlier today actually suggest that the WNBA, for their opening night game with the Indiana Fever, should be preempting the NHL playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, look, when it comes down to it, this is the biggest unicorn the WNBA's ever seen. It's the greatest opportunity yet. And unless the Fever make the finals, which they're not going to, right? You know, as Diana Taurasi said, reality will set in. But this is the opportunity to get the biggest audience maybe in WNBA history. The current mark is 5 million for the first game. But this is the first game in WNBA history, right? It's a reboot. The WNBA is rebooting. And this is like the pilot episode of the new version of the WNBA. It needs to be at least on ESPN. They can't get it on ABC. ABC has new episodes of primetime shows. And realistically, I don't know that the game will outdraw them. But at least ESPN. You've got two game fives potentially in the hockey playoffs. To me, two game fives in the hockey playoffs is not something that I would be afraid to preempt. Now, if the contract says you can't move these games off of ESPN for anything other than the NFL, then so be it. First of all, the WNBA never does a good, you know, job of scheduling. I mean, I guess I kind of get the symmetry because Diana opened her career at UConn, or not at UConn, excuse me, at the Connecticut Sun. Her first game was at Mohegan. But like, why is Caitlin Clark opening up? You know, why is Caitlin opening up in Connecticut and not New York? Nobody cares about the Connecticut Sun. No offense to the Connecticut Sun. They're a low-profile team. They're the closest thing to San Antonio that, you know, that the WNBA has. Why not have Caitlin Clark opening up in New York? Why is Caitlin Clark's first home game on Amazon Prime? Caitlin Clark's first home game is a big event that should be on ESPN. So there's, you know, whatever. I've had my quibbles with the WNBA. At the very least, that first game needs to be on big ESPN.
Well, back to the draft for a second. Let's just compare to the other major professional sports leagues drafts this past year. So the NBA, which was Victor Wembanyama's draft class last year, got $3.74 million. So that was a pretty good number for them. That was up. Obviously, comparing this to the NFL is a bit silly, but their three-day average was $6 million across three networks, ABC, ESPN, NFL, and Network. But this draft did beat the NHL and MLB drafts. The Connor Bedard draft class for the NHL got 681,000, much below the WNBA number. The MLB draft also under 1,744,000 last year for their first round on ESPN and MLB Network. So this is not only just a good, you know, women's basketball number. This is a great number overall when you're comparing it across other drafts.
Yeah, of course. And as you said, comfortably beating the record audience for the you know, the Bedard draft last year. I mean, to be as close as it was to the Wembanyama draft is crazy, because that had ABC and less competition late June. So there's no words to describe it. I saw somebody on Twitter say that it was close to the second night of the NFL draft. I'd have to check that, but I mean, that sounds right, and that's kind of amazing. So it's an amazing golden opportunity for the WNBA. There's never been one like this. There's no point in even saying, well, if the WNBA doesn't capitalize on this, then blank. The WNBA will capitalize on it. Not even the WNBA could blow this. That's what I'm saying, all right? Not even the WNBA could blow this. This is, you know, a gift. And as long as, you know, You'd better make sure that he's getting fouls called on her. I saw a few plays in the tournament where he was like, you know, people were stepping in her landing space. Man, let me tell you something. He'd better be Michael times 10. Because you got to protect her. You got to make sure she's healthy.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
All right, John, let's move on to the NBA, which wrapped up its regular season, which means we have some season averages to look at. So let's go through some of those numbers. The regular season for the NBA across the four networks of ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV were up just a tick of 1% from last year, averaged 1.09 million viewers per game. Across the three main broadcasters, ABC, ESPN, and TNT, the average was 1.56 million, a slight downtick of 1% from last year. What were your top line takeaways here, John, from the NBA's season long numbers?
I mean, it's not going to, you know, call the dogs off. The NBA will probably never be able to get the dogs called off of it. But look, I mean, the numbers are fine. You know, they're not great. It was a 4-year high across ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV. I didn't really lean into that because it was one of those where, yeah, but we normally look at ABC, ESPN, and TNT. So, you know, it would, you know, if you look back at most of the years I've written about the NBA's audience, most of the time I'm talking only ABC, ESPN, and TNT. So it would feel a little dishonest to suddenly say, well, if you include NBA TV, it's a 4-year high. I mean, obviously it was. It was the most watched season in 4 years, up 1%. You know, I mean, look, like I said, the NBA is not out of the, you know, the circumstance it was in. Frankly, this is where the NBA is going to be. So stop complaining about it. The NBA is clearly not falling further. This is just kind of where it is. Frankly, I think it's a pretty decent place to be. The league is still winning most nights, still getting representative numbers that beat most other sporting events on any given day. You know, I mean, it's one of those where you kind of shrug a little bit. It's all right. I don't see any reason to celebrate too much, or certainly any reason to condemn.
Did you expect a bigger increase after the success of the in-season tournament earlier this year? I mean, with the first year of the tournament, it generated some pretty large audiences at a time when the NBA traditionally has not gotten very large audiences.
No, not really. I think the in-season tournament certainly helped. But once Christmas came in, you know, 30% decline in 1 year for the biggest games of the season, to get a 1% increase after that is pretty damn good, if you ask me. Look, it is what it is. The Christmas games were a factor. The Wednesday night ABC games, my understanding is there's some belief that those negatively impacted the numbers, but I don't see how they could have, because those games still did better on ABC than they would have done on ESPN. Now, the counter is the ESPN games did really badly on those Wednesday nights, but I think it all kind of evens out in the wash, right? I don't think that really had a negative impact, but when all is said and done, next year, the Christmas games will do better. I mean, I know people are going, oh, wow, the NFL is really coming for the NBA. And I'm like, well, there's going to be one less Christmas NFL game next year. And assuming none of the games here on ABC, there'll be every opportunity to have all five Christmas games simulcast on ABC. The NBA will probably, barring any injuries to stars, probably get a 15, 20, maybe even 25 to 30% increase for those Christmas games next year. And frankly, you know, I mean, that might be enough. Next year, all things being equal, you're up maybe a decent amount overall in viewership.
Let's quickly look at the playoff picture here, because, of course, this is where the NBA's bread is buttered. I'm sure we'll have a more in-depth discussion next week on how the playoffs are shaping up. But looking at it before the play-in games have happened, How do you think the NBA playoffs are shaping up from a viewership perspective?
Very interesting question because we don't know yet. We're taping Tuesday. The games in the play-in tournament have not yet been played. If the Lakers win on Tuesday and set up a first round meeting with the Nuggets, that's good and not so good. It's good because that's a really nice marquee first round series. Not so good because the Lakers are going to lose it, right? So you can pretty much, wrap up the idea of the Lakers. I'll put it this way: Lakers getting Denver in the first round is good because it guarantees the Lakers are at least in the playoffs and it guarantees you a marquee series, but you also are pretty set that the Lakers will not be making it back to the conference finals or the second round. But at least you get them in there and you get a really good first round. Well, assuming the Lakers get a game. Assuming they get a game. Hopefully they'll get one, maybe two games, you know? So you need the Lakers to win because I don't think you want to gamble with that second play-in game. If you can guarantee that the Lakers are in, that's what you want, even if it means Denver. Then you want the Warriors to win, obviously. You want the Warriors to win tonight. You want the Warriors to win on Friday. That means you have the Lakers and Warriors in the playoffs. You have the Lakers against Denver, a marquee series. You have Golden State in a winnable series against an inexperienced OKC team. Maybe you rekindle the We Believe 8-seed Warriors a little bit. Best case scenario. Best case scenario is the Lakers and Warriors win tonight, and then the Warriors win again on Friday. Let's say it doesn't work out. If the Lakers lose today, then you can only get one of those two teams in. As long as you get one, you're fine, but you can only get one. And then you're also saddled with a New Orleans Denver series that's really made for NBA TV. So that's really the big result. There was a stroke of luck to get New York in the into the two seed because that sets up a potential Philadelphia New York first round series that could do well. Or Philadelphia Boston, that could do really well, especially if Embiid is healthy. Second round matchup, maybe Milwaukee, New York, Milwaukee, Philly, that's all right. Obviously, you don't want Cleveland, Orlando in the playoffs. It's not 2009 anymore, but you have it. One of those teams is going to be losing to Boston in like four games. Look, let's just be real about what we're seeing here. It's the viewership is going to be down. Last year was best case scenario in every round until the finals. There's no way to match that. The best case for the NBA this year is that you keep within maybe single digit percentage points of last year, and then the finals does better because you have maybe Boston, Denver, and it goes seven.
We'll have more on the NBA playoffs next week as the playoff picture comes into focus. But now let's move on to our final topic here, and that would be the Masters, which saw a pretty sharp decline in viewership from last year. This year's final round Sunday came in at a average of 9.59 million viewers, down from just under 12 million last year. For the final round, of course, the big reason here, last year's final round fell on Easter, which is now a big out-of-home viewing holiday. This year, that was not the case. It was down 20% in the viewership, 5% in the ratings. The difference there, you can attribute to the out-of-home viewing.
Yeah, as you said, out of home is the reason for the particularly significant decline from last year. Look, it's a lot to ask people to sit down in their homes and, consume 4 hours of golf. From that perspective, I think 9 million viewers is pretty good. What more can you ask for in 2024 than for 9 million people to sit down in their homes and consume golf instead of, a beautiful day outside or anything on the internet? The Masters really realistically is going to keep dropping. The audience for golf is going to keep growing older. It's going to age out of the demos and just, generally as well, not to go to a dark place, but that's just the reality of life. And I think in 10 years' time, you're going to be looking at maybe COVID era numbers every year. 5-ish million viewers every year. It's a lot to ask people to sit down and watch golf. And you talk about all this stuff at the PGA and LIV. It's very fascinating to see a sport that it's a lot like open wheel racing. Open wheel racing was never that popular. They were killing a goose that wasn't particularly golden. They were just killing a regular gray goose.
I'm not sure I totally buy the premise that golf, or at least the Masters viewership, is going to see that large of a decline over the next 10 years. I actually see the final round of the Masters as kind of a pretty inelastic viewership draw, right? Where it's not going to deviate too much from where it is right now. I kind of compare it more to that of a Kentucky Derby, which has also seen its viewership decline in recent years. If you look at some of the Masters final rounds from the early 2000s, you're getting a lot of 11, 12, 13 millions in there as well, which isn't too far off from the 10 million, around 10 million that it got this year. I think the bigger problem right now with golf is the disillusionment among actual golf fans. I think there's just been a lot of apathy to the, you know, dilution of the regular season. The PGA versus LIV stuff is very tiring, but I think there's opportunity there if they're able to unify and come up with a regular season that is actually getting the best golfers playing in the same tournaments on a regular basis. Golf is actually a sport that is growing when you're looking at it from a non-viewership perspective. You know, since the pandemic, golf has skyrocketed in popularity. So there's an untapped market, I think, for golf viewership, but they have yet to capitalize because of the circumstances surrounding the professional game.
Yeah, I think you make a great point about the fact that golf is growing as a participatory event. People are playing more golf, but I still feel, you know, I know you say the viewership is inelastic, but there wasn't, you know, wasn't that long ago that 9 million viewers would have been viewed as a shocking number for this. And we're now at the point where that's just pretty much where it's going to be. So I still feel like a decade's a long time, and maybe it won't be 5 million, but it certainly is not going to be 9. I think it'll be maybe 6, 7. I don't know. But it's not going to be 9. Unless they get a Caitlin Clark in there. You know, they used to have one named Tiger Woods, and they're going to need something. You know, Spieth not living up to the hype, and Rory not living up to the hype. That really hurt the sport.
I mean, even Tiger in 2019 only drew 10.8 million when he won. But of course, that was an early morning tea time due to weather. So that definitely an asterisk there. But I get your point. There is no unicorn in golf right now. The sport may start looking a lot more like tennis, where the four majors are really the only thing people care about, and you kind of just tune in and out.
Let's go ahead and wrap this up for today. Interesting stuff. You know, 6 straight weeks talking Caitlin Clark at the top of the show. Her impact has been really unbelievable. And who knows where it goes from here. She's 23 years old. You know, the day she was born, she was born on the day that ESPN and ABC announced their NBA media rights deal in 2002. That happened the day she was born. So a very consequential day in basketball history, certainly, from a media standpoint.
That's only a fact that you'll hear on the Sports Media Watch podcast. You can't get that anywhere else, folks.
Well, I'm the only person who would see the day Caitlin Clark was born and immediately know that was the day that the NBA and ABC signed their rights.
That's very true. That's very true.
So, yep. And she's only 23 years old. Given what we are seeing in sports, she could play till she's 45. The next 20 years plus, if she stays healthy and if she is anything close to what she's been so far, the next 20 years are going to be transformative for women's basketball and women's sports in general. Well, we'll be back here next week. We'll talk more about the NBA playoffs. I doubt we'll lead with Caitlin Clark next week, but who knows? Who knows what'll happen between now and then? But for now, thanks for listening, and we'll be back with more stuff.